Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. So much has been written about the Bush family in St. Louis, we might think we know all there is to know about the clan that brought us Budweiser. The family has been a major part of the community narrative for a century and a half. It created jobs for generations and funded numerous charitable good works in the community. It's put its name on entertainment venues downtown and across the country, amassing incredible wealth along the way. But the narrative has its dark and disappointing sides, too. The life and style of this rich and famous family is told in a new book, Bitter Brew, The Rise and Fall of Anheuser-Busch and America's Kings of Beer. Author William Nadelseeder joins us from California to talk about lifting the veil on what many call St. Louis's first family. Bill, thanks so much for being with us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
In a sense, this is kind of a homecoming for you, is it not? I mean, we're broadcasting from a University of Missouri St. Louis facility, and you're an UMSL grad.
I am, and yes, and it's St. Louis is my hometown. I was born and raised there.
Well, no wonder then.
Steeped in this story from birth.
Yeah, as many generations have been.
Right.
You know, I have to admit to you, Bill, and I enjoyed the book. I thought when I picked it up, oh, here we go again, yet another book about the Bush family. There have been several in the last recent years. And I thought, what am I going to learn that I didn't know before? But I found it most enjoyable, very, very readable. But what caused you to take it on again?
Well, I always, you know, loved the story. I was interested in the story. I have my memory of going to Grant's Farm when I was a kid is just burned into my brain. I can see it. I can smell it the first time I was there. And you know, when I first came out to Los Angeles in the late 70s, early 80s, I actually tried to sell a television series, you know, based on a family that owns a brewery and a ball team and blah, 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 you know, and I submitted it around and everybody turned it down and said they didn't think it was as interesting as, you know, a family of, with oil money in Dallas, you know. So I let it go, and then the other book, Under the Influence, came out, you know, and I was like, oh, man, there's my chance. I always wanted to do this. And then 20 years passed, and I'm in St. Louis promoting my last book, and someone introduced me to Adolphus Busch IV, and we got to talking about books. And he said he always wanted someone to write the real story about his family, and would I be interested? And I said, well, sure, I'd be interested, but, you know, I don't do books for hire. And you know, but he said, well, how would it work then? And I said, well, you tell me everything, and then I write the book, and it's mine. You know, and you trust me to handle your story. So we went from there, and that's what happened. I mean, all of a sudden I had someone in the Bush family who was willing to talk on the record for the first time. And that's what I never knew. I thought from reading the other books that because the family didn't participate in them in any way or didn't talk, it was all other people talking about them, that they came off as sort of like cardboard cutouts. It's the best you can do if they don't talk.
But
they
can't
tell you what it was like inside the, you know.
I can't imagine that all that many members of the family would really be interested in having the full story told, because a lot of it is sordid. A lot of it is very, very unflattering.
Well, some of it is too, but there's also great stuff in there. There's heroic stuff in there. There's great accomplishment. There's all kinds of stuff. That's how I saw it. I mean, you know, any family has stuff like that in it, especially a family that large, stretching over that many years. It's just that their foibles don't get all the ink because the name doesn't ring a bell like the Bush family does. You know. So I thought that was, you know, my favorite parts of the book. Maybe it's because how I approached it or what was in me to begin with was the stories of what it was like inside Grant's Farm in the 50s and 60s and 70s when Gussie was the lord of the manor and it was Camelot. That was, you know, I just thought that was just so fascinating. And the media tends to pick up on the August the 4th stuff, the headline stuff, but I sort of like the other stuff better.
And yet you devoted a great deal of time, a great deal of space in the book to August 4th.
Yeah, about three chapters, I think, out of all of them. Yeah, that's the decline part of the story. That's, you know, the thing that interested me when I first talked to Adolphus Busch is at that point in time there was an ending to the story. Under the Influence was written, there really wasn't. They had a book, they turned it in, they did it, but it didn't really have there was no closure to it. It was just sort of continuing on. All of a sudden, when the company was sold, you had an arc of a story there that runs from 3 days after Abraham Lincoln was first inaugurated to the week that Barack Obama was first was elected. So that's the story of Anheuser-Busch as an independent, family-run American company. And you know, you can tell the story of America during that time through that company and the people and the five guys who ran it, which is what hit me. Is like, oh, now there's really a story that you can sum something up. You can, you know, and that's, you know, that's what compelled me to do it.
But the saga continues, at least as far as personalities are concerned, and I'm thinking specifically of the death of the young woman at young Bush's place out in Huntley, Adrian Martin.
Yeah.
That continues the story, and it's getting still a lot of attention.
Oh yeah, I don't think the story's over yet. It will continue on. There's you know, my guess is that there may be headlines still written. You know. That was a tragic story, and I was working on the book when that happened. I was in the middle of working on the book when, you know, the news flash came that a young woman was found in his bed. And I had done a lot of research on, you know, where he was and what he was doing, and I had been talking to a lot of, you know, people who were very close to him and confidants of his, and you know, the surprise was that it was her and not him that was found dead because, you know, of his issues, put it that way.
Well, his issues, as pointed out in the book, had to do with too much alcohol and too many drugs.
That would be it. That was an issue dating back many, many years to when he was a young man, college, you know, possibly earlier. And, you know, it's disguised for a number of years because it looks like it comes with the territory. You're working for a beer company. You're the guy, you know. He was destined to be head of this beer company. He had really no choice. The day he was born, he was expected to be the head of the beer company, and the job was his every day of his life to lose, and he knew that. And that's a lot of pressure to be under, especially if perhaps you're not ideally suited to be that guy and to play that role in your life, to be the, you know, hail hearty beer man with the hand outstretched. Hey, I'm you know, so-and-so Bush, and I'd like to buy you Budweiser. If that's not you, you know, you're getting jammed into that. So he had these issues going way back, and they could be dismissed as, oh yeah, it's just, you know, it's playboy lifestyle, you know, recreational, you know, use of whatnot, because, you know, they all did that. They, you know, they would go out and, you know, on the road, and people would get loaded, and, you know, it was sort of went with the territory. But after a number of years, it sort of became clear to some of them, and it took a lot of years for some of them to realize that this is something more than recreational issues with him, and it's serious, and it turned deadly.
I didn't plan to start this discussion at the end of the book, but
right.
I'm going to stick with it for a while, because
okay.
I wanted to ask, do you think the issues that he had, and which were becoming increasingly well known at about the time that the brewery was sold to InBev, do you think that that his issues could be called directly responsible for the decision to sell?
No, I think that would be a stretch. I think that they may have been indirectly connected to the vulnerability of the company to sale, because he had been the president and he was now the CEO, and during the 5 years that he was in those two positions, the stock had been flat, which was what left them vulnerable to take over by a company that was, you know, growing, you know, in you know, daily in size and a very voracious company. That could do that. And as time went on, his issues as he was moved up in the company. I mean, one thing that happened that's in the book is that a good deal of time of other executives was taken up with his issues, meaning they were, you know, on the job. Part of their job was to make sure that when he was on the road, that there were women available and you know, and all that. And there was a guy who you know, lined up the women down in Key West and things like that. Well, you know, this is a public company. These are highly paid executives, and this is what they spend their time doing. It sort of subverted some of the managerial processes of the company. You know, that's
The scope,
you know, that's a problem.
The scope of that womenizing and the amount of money that was spent to accomplish some of these parties is just staggering. You write in one case of a party, a weekend party down in the, I think it was the Miami area, where they spent $200,000 on this stuff.
Yeah, that was down in Key West. That was that was according to people who provisioned the party. You know, it was that sort of life. I mean, that was, he just took everything one step further than it had been before. Anheuser-Busch, part of their style was profligate spending on anything that was promotional. I mean, for years, their motto, in a way, it was admirable in a lot of ways, you know, making friends is our business. That's what Adolphus Busch, the first guy, came up with. You know, making friends is our business. And if we make friends, we sell beer. Well, if your motto is making friends is our business, and you've got a lot of money, that forgives a lot of sins. You know, yeah, I was just making friends. You buy friends, you do this, you spend. They spent lavishly. That's the way they did business, and it earned them a reputation of being a very classy operation that took care of their employees. There was a real good side to that too, but there was the danger. You could go off the ends, and that's kind of what happened toward the end. I mean, you know, this sort of spending was, you know, wildly inappropriate.
One of the things that struck me is the fact that he achieved this position of the presidency of the company in spite of all of this, and because he was taking credit for things that he should not have taken credit for. I mean, you talk about some of the marketing and the commercials that he was more than happy to say that he was responsible for when he actually wasn't.
Well, you know, I would amend that to say he was being given credit for it, which he accepted, which was not corrected. It was all part of the myth that was built that, you know, that he was responsible for all the great marketing. And he's responsible in the sense that he was in charge. During the time that he was in charge of advertising and marketing and things like that, it was one of their greatest periods of creativity. And it's when their advertising became part of the American pop culture lexicon. So you have to give him credit for that. But, you know, the media and a lot of the idolatrous articles gave him direct credit for coming up with ideas that he didn't come up with. And it became part of the myth of his genius. And there's no doubt that he had a talent for that, you know, that he may have been a very good head of advertising for the company, you know, forever. And it's when he moved beyond that that it got, you know, that he wasn't the organizational person.
I'm talking to Bill Nadelseder, who is the author of Bitter Brew, which is the story of the Busch family here in St. Louis, the famous Budweiser family, of course. And we'll continue our conversation in just a moment. Bill, it's really a pleasure to talk to you, and I just want to make one point before I go to this break, and that is earlier in the conversation you were talking about how you were interested in going out to Hollywood and coming up with some sort of a series on a family such as the Busch family. And now I understand a cable series may be in the works on the basis of this book.
Well, yes, it was optioned to Lionsgate Television, which is the company that makes Mad Men, and they're developing it as a potential series, you know, for cable.
Well, that I'm sure makes you very, very happy, Bill.
Well, yes, it does.
Bill Nadelseder is our guest, the author of Bitter Brew. We'll be back in just a moment to continue our conversation. We'll back it up from more or less the present or the most recent history to some of the earlier things about this very, very famous family. And we certainly would like to hear from you. Why are we so fascinated by this family? Give us a call if you have some ideas at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. An email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. A tweet at STL on air, or reach us through Facebook. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back. Bill Nadelseder is our guest. He is the author of Bitter Brew, the story of the Busch family here in St. Louis. Bill, would it be fair to say that from the very, very get-go, beer came first, even to a very large degree, before family among the Bushes, going all the way back to Adolphus 150 years ago?
I don't know. I guess that could be true because, you know, he was all about beer in the beginning, and it all came from that. I mean, when he stepped off the boat, there were 40 breweries in operating in St. Louis at the time. He was only 18, and he was a single guy looking to make his fortune in America, and he certainly did that. He was a gifted salesman, clearly, and he was also more of an industrialist than any of the other brewery owners or brewers. He was more of an industrialist than a brewer, really. And he's the one who figured out, how to take beer beyond its market. In the early days, the beer was hyper-local. You just sold in the neighborhood because there was a cooling issue. One of the reasons that St. Louis became a brewing center was all the caves down by the river where you could store the beer, keep it cool longer, so you could space out you could elongate the selling of it, the selling season. But he figured out that you could pasteurize beer like they had just started pasteurizing wine. And he bottled it, pasteurized it, put it in bottles, and started shipping it outside the St. Louis and out all around the country. And he established the first national brand of beer, and the money started pouring in. You know, now he came from a very large family. He came from a family of 22 children, and he had 13. So, it's a little bit hard to say which came first, but beer made it all happen. That's for sure. And they helped turn. He was the key guy in turning America into a beer drinking nation, because as the Germans came to America starting in the mid 1800s, they, unlike the Irish who came starving and had to fight their way in block by block into New York, Germans arrived with more money and they came into the interior of the country and settled. And as they came in huge numbers, along with the Irish, who were also, that's another beer-drinking country, they established breweries because they know how to do that, and they also knew that there was a growing demand. And he sort of foresaw that beer could become a national drink. We had been a whiskey-drinking country in terms of alcoholic beverages anyway. And so he kept plowing money back into increased production, and he foresaw it, and he actually made it happen before he died, long before he died. America became the largest beer-producing country, more so than Germany.
Well, part of his story also was his ability to market that beer. He was quite a genius at that, from what I understand from your book. What specifically was he doing to push himself ahead of those 40 other brands locally?
Well, he figured out that he was doing vertical integration before there was a name for it. He realized that, okay, if I'm shipping this beer around the country, I can buy the company that builds the rail cars. I should buy the company that makes the bottles that we're using. So he became very diversified, and he invested his money well, so that when Prohibition did come, everything wasn't in beer. He had other things that his then son, who took over the company, could rely upon to keep the company functioning in some way through the very hard times of World War One and then Prohibition, and then on top of that came the Depression. So they survived, three tsunamis in a sense, and which wiped out all the other competition,
This is a story obviously about beer, but also about fathers and sons, isn't it? Because the relationship between all of them since Adolphus came to town was a big part of the story.
It's the succession of kings. That's there's no doubt about it. It's Shakespearean and even Roman. I mean, in terms of, when I was working on it, you would see the patterns that repeated itself between father and son, and it was astonishing because in details, it repeated itself. And it seemed to me that the way it was, there was always the firstborn son who was the first in line to do it. Primogeniture is how they decided this. And it seemed to me that this is what happened, the firstborn son was sort of offered in sacrifice to the company. Okay, he was born, this is the person who was going to take it over. And then what happened was he then had to run the company under the eye and the criticism of a very stern, critical father, and it really affected their relationship. And then the father developed a much closer relationship with the second oldest son, who was born to his second wife. And it happened again and again, the same pattern.
And how did the second-born or third-born or whatever the case might have been down the various lines, how did they take to this? Did they just quietly accept it?
Yeah, they did. I mean, Adolphus IV, for example, Gussie, August III was destined to take over the company, and he did. His closest sibling was his half-brother, Adolphus IV, who always assumed, and his father let him believe that he assumed that he would sort of be in line to take over after his brother August the Third, because who was much older than he was, you know, 17 years or something like that. But things interfered with that, and he didn't get to do that because of the split in the family that resulted from the succession between August Gussie and August the Third.
And
where,
that relation
split in the family because August the Third deposed his father.
Right. Yeah, we'll get to that in a moment. But what prior to that, what was the relationship like between Gussie, who was probably the most familiar Bush in this community, and August III?
It was always difficult because, you know, August the Third had his own ideas. He was very ambitious. He wanted to take over the country. He thought he was ready to do it by the time he hit his early 30s, and Gussie wasn't about to. You know, Gussie planned to die in the executive chair. He was not going to pass on the reins until he was dead, and he pretty much said so. And so August chafed under this. It's sort of like, you know, Prince Charles waiting to take over, you know, the throne. And Gussie was a very tough guy to work for, and he would undermine his son. He would countermand what he said. He would do all this other stuff, and so there was stuff going on constantly inside the company. You know, who are you with? Are you with Gussie? You know, or are you with the Third? And the Third had his guys who were just waiting for the day that Gussie would somehow loosen his grip on everything.
You know, I think there was a perception in this community maybe that August 3 might have been something of a lightweight because of all of this that was going on. But I took from your book that he was actually a pretty sharp guy. He is. I mean, he's still alive, of course. Pretty sharp guy.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, he was a stern figure and scared a lot of people because of his demeanor. But, I mean, this is, you think about it. He took that company from 10 million barrels a year to 100 million barrels a year. In fact, made his father a billionaire. You know, so that's nothing to that's he took that company in into the stratosphere that his father and grandfather and great-grandfather, you know, never imagined. So, yeah, he was very, very talented.
There's a lot to talk about, but we have a telephone call here I'd like to bring up right away. It should be interesting. Jerry and Kirkwood, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, good morning.
Thank you.
I have read The Bitter Brew. I've read Under the Influence. I've read Dethroning the King. The Bush family has just been a huge influence on this whole community and anybody involved in it. I personally was pretty much, it dominated a big part of my life. I was creative director on Budweiser for 6 years at the old Darcy Advertising.
Ah, yes.
And so I know some of the players. I would love to know. You have some, uncredited comments in there, and I don't blame the people for not wanting their names in the book. You know, it's funny, even today, I can be at a restaurant and talking to people about Anheuser-Busch, and before I mention August or the 3rd or the 4th, before I mention anybody's name at the brewery, I kind of look around to make sure none of the brewery people are sitting there.
Yeah.
It's like a prevailing
power. Well,
everybody
in St. Louis knows someone who works there or has a relative who works there. It's like in Los Angeles, everybody's second business is show business. In St. Louis, it always seemed like everybody's second business was the brewery. You know, you everybody had a connection there.
Well, it was spread out. It was much more than beer in modern history because of baseball, among other things, and some of the other entertainment operations they were involved in. There were many different ways that the family and the name could touch your life.
Yeah.
Right. One comment about, I worked on a lot of different accounts, but Anheuser-Busch was different. I worked on Busch Beer, and I worked on Budweiser and Busch Gardens. And it was not just an account. It was not just a business. It was more like a culture. When you went over to the brewery, you were in a different world there because of the people and because of all the things in the book you have, this legacy. You could just feel it all around you, and it was blood. It wasn't just beer, it was blood.
Right. I tried to capture that in the book because I heard that again and again and again, that everybody remembers it as like the best time of their life, sort of. You know, I was like, wow, that's going to be
great. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
To quote Charles Dickens.
Yes. Right.
You know, another thing that impressed – thank you for the call. Another thing that impressed me, Bill, so much about the book was the amount of influence that the family had, which I guess doesn't surprise any of us who have watched Dallas and Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. But if anybody got – in a jam, as many of them did, they could find the very most expensive and most professional way of getting out of that jam.
And you know, if you were them, wouldn't you? If your son got into trouble and you had everything at your you know, wouldn't you do the same thing? I mean, I sure would myself, you know. So we can criticize them with that. But in terms of their influence, I remember the moment, and I've said this before. I don't want to be repetitive, but I was at when I was doing the book, I went to the Cardinals game, and I was going into the stadium, my first time in the new stadium, and the sea of people in red shirts, and I was the only person with a blue shirt out of 50,000, you know, it seemed. And I was struck by the fact that what would it have been like if Adolphus Busch had stepped off the boat in Cleveland instead of St. Louis? What would the story of St. Louis have been, you know, if he hadn't founded that brewery, and if his son hadn't kept it open during the Depression, if his son hadn't bought the Cardinals? What would it be? And it wouldn't be as good, I don't think. I think you could make the case that, you know, that they can be criticized for this and that, but they made life better for thousands and thousands and thousands of people. You know, and you can't take that away from them. And in all families, we all have everybody has their dark side. Everybody, you know. But you know, when you're in the eye of the media like that, everything you do wrong is amplified and looks, you know. And there is a double-edged sword to that.
All right. Well, that's an interesting way to look at it. What would Cleveland be like if the Bush family had settled there? You know, we had Billy Bush in our studio here a few months ago as he was unveiling his Kräftig beer, which is the tradition continues as he's trying to make a go of it with that. I bring up his name because we have a caller from Brentwood who wants to bring Billy Bush into the conversation. So let's let Rick make the point that he'd like to make. Go ahead, Rick.
Thank you. How is it that we never hear any additional information about Billy Bush and the alleged killing of his lover in the mansion off of Grand Valley? I've tried to research
Let me correct you. Billy Bush.
It seems to have been expunged.
Go ahead, Bill. I think.
Well, number one, that wasn't that didn't involve Billy Bush. That involved Peter Bush, and. As you know, I covered it in the book. It's in the newspapers. It was adjudicated out as the allegation that you made that it was his lover. I don't know that that's borne out anywhere. So I don't really know what else to say. There's no secret to what happened there. I mean, and there was no ever any suspicion on the part of the law enforcement or anyone else that it was intentional or anything other than a careless. Handling of a weapon that resulted in the death, you know, and so I don't think anything's being covered up.
Well, I think there's a widespread impression, or was at the time, that there was some sort of a cover up because, as I recall the story, there were some members of the security team out at the Bush estate who were employed by the St. Louis Police Department, and it was suggested that they were out there to clean things up before the investigation really got going.
You know, if you go through the Post Dispatch and the Globe Democrat clips, you don't find anything about that. No doubt there were people on the staff who were on the police department. That was always the case with the Bush family. They were the number two employer of police personnel in St. Louis for years, because they would hire them, you know, off duty as security and whatnot. You know, a lot of this may be speculation. You know, the record is that the police never for a minute thought that there was any intent in this killing.
He took a
lie detector test within an hour or so afterwards. You know,
for people not familiar with the story, they were in a bedroom and the son Peter says that he tossed a gun, I think it was, to his friend who was spending the night, and the gun accidentally went off, killing the friend.
That became a problem because they pretty much established that couldn't have happened that way, because the gun, it took so much force to fire that gun, you know, that it couldn't go off that way. You literally had to fire pull the trigger. It wouldn't just accidentally go off. So his original story didn't hold up, and he eventually pleaded guilty to whatever the original charge was, which was, you know, reckless. I can't tell you from memory what it was. And he did not plea bargain, didn't make a deal, and the judge gave him 5 years probation.
Well, you can, certainly in the business, you're in investigative reporting. You can certainly understand why all of this speculation surfaced here in the city because of the background of this family and some of the key players in it. I mean, it's all the city was talking about during this particular
period. And I was there at the time. I remember it.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah, I do remember. But when you look into it, you know, here's what it was. You know, it was a tragedy for the other family, and I'm sure that they didn't get a very good deal in it. I mean, there was upset because they were making some sort of press conference at the gates of Grant's Farm at the same time they were telling the family that someone had been killed. I sort of explained that a little bit in the book. The reason it wasn't handled very well, at least I think, and from what I'm able to discern, was that at that particular period in time, Gussie was not in top form, and his wife Trudy was out of the country. So it was left to the two young men, you know, Adolphus and Teeter, the brothers, to sort of handle this with some lawyers, and the lawyers got involved, and it was sloppy.
Do you think the media has done over the years a good job of covering this family and these incidents?
Yeah, I think they've done a good job, and it's hit and miss. I mean, there are times when, you know, some of the coverage is like, you know, ooh, wow, you know. Like, you know, when August the 3rd is a young teenager and he gets into a fracas, you know, on Halloween with some girls, you know, coming to his house and throwing stuff, and he shoots a pellet gun at him. And, you know, well, it was played up in the papers, you know, headlines and all that. Had it been my name instead of Bush, they wouldn't have appeared in the paper.
Sure.
And nobody would. This is a contretemps among teenagers on Halloween. This doesn't make headlines unless you're Bush. You know, when Billy Bush gets into the thing and right at the same time, his quote unquote scandal was he was fighting for custody of an out of wedlock child with a girlfriend with a very checkered background who was a drug addict and all this stuff. And the newspapers, if you read the stories, you know, went with the salacious testimony and played it as kind of a scandal. And nobody ever really brought out and played up the fact or pointed out that this was a single guy who was spending money and fighting for custody of an out-of-wedlock child. He was doing the right thing. He was a stand-up guy. But that's not how it played.
But prior to that, the only exposure anybody here in the town had to Billy Bush was the fact that he bit off somebody's ear during a barroom fight.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
And, you know, is he the one who bit off the guy's ear? Well, yeah, that's
right,
the guy.
Right. Yeah. Bill, I've got to take another break. We'll do that and come back. We have many more questions and callers and emails. Bill Nadelzieder is our guest. He's the author of Bitter Brew, which is the story of the Bush family. We'll come back and continue our conversation. If you'd like to get in on it, give us a call at 382-TALK, which is 382-8255. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back as we continue our conversation with Bill Nadelzieder, who is the author of Bitter Brew, the story of the Bush family. I have an email here, Bill, I'd like to read to you. It says, thanks for the conversation. I was wondering if any members of the Bush family said anything to the author, anything that he is allowed to repeat at least, about the future of Grant's Farm, both as a tourist attraction after the InBev takeover, and about the future of the property in general.
Well, let's see. You know, I'm trying to think what I know about that, and no one, you know, what I know is that they don't all agree. The six surviving children of Grant's Farm, I mean, Gussie's children who were born at Grant's Farm, they own it jointly. His will said that they couldn't sell it, you know, outside themselves, and he just sort of assumed that they would settle it. And they're not all in agreement as to what to do with it. I know that the general consensus among them is that it costs them more a year to operate it than they get from their lease with InBev. The InBev leases most of it, except for the residential dwellings there, and it doesn't cover the cost, they say. So they lose money every year. They don't really want to part with it. I mean, some of them, I mean, Billy, you know, would be the one who would least want to part with it because he was the last one there and he had a particular, and they still go out there and spend weekends with their children and, you know, although no one lives there full time. And I don't think that they were going to, you know, my sense is that the park, you know, the thing wasn't going to go with the park service, wasn't going to happen. So they're trying to figure out what their options are. They've got until, you know, October of next year or something like that till they have to decide. So it's up in the air. I don't really know.
There are very few people in the St. Louis area who haven't had spent at least some time at Grant's Farm. It is to say a very, very popular spot. While we're
talking,
go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, after you.
Oh, it's sort of like St. Louis's version of Hearst Castle. I mean, it's a remarkable place, and you'd be surprised how many people outside of St. Louis have never heard of it, don't know of it, and it should be a destination place. So as far as I'm concerned, I'm very biased toward Grants Farm. You know, one of the best things I did when I was researching the book was I was allowed to kind of wander around, you know, and take it in, and you know, without not on a tour, and got to walk through the house, and you know, I was in Gussie's bedroom, and you know, it's an amazing thing to experience. Imagine what it must have been like back then.
It brings me to something else that came up before we went on the air today. Maybe you can help us separate fact from fiction. For years, we've been hearing stories that Walt Disney wanted to build, actually, Disneyland on the riverfront property here in St. Louis. And he is a Missourian, of course. And Gussie Bush actually scotched that idea because Disney would not have allowed the sale of beer on that property. Is that fact or fiction? Do you know?
Well, you know, I don't really know, but I do know that it would be absolutely true that Gussie wouldn't have done it if beer wasn't sold. And I know that there was some discussions, you know, that there was some discussion about, you know, joining two things together, because why not? I mean, Disney and Anheuser-Busch were the one and two, recreational companies, you know, for resort stuff after a while. So it would make sense. I don't know whether that's fact.
Yeah, it's been circulating for a long time, and I had always thought it was an urban myth, but I've certainly been wrong before. Let's bring in another.
I tend to think it's true, but I don't have any information on that.
Okay. Well, that's your next book, then. That's your next assignment, Bill.
There you go. Thanks.
Let's bring in Phil calling from Ladue. Phil, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
The author bandies around the facts that in a murder investigation or a shooting investigation, off-duty law enforcement officers on behalf of the Bush family made false statements and removed evidence. And there was false statements given to the police as to how the shooting occurred. Now, this country is divided into two camps. The 2% of the super rich, the 2% of the people that make 73% of the money in this country, and the rest of us. And another layer is possibly the police, who think they can gain some sort of advantage by lying for super rich people.
Phil, I'm going to stop you right there because we have a very bad connection. It sounds like you're in a windstorm of some sort. I don't know what the validity of your information about false statements, but let's take it back to the man who investigated this himself. Bill, go ahead. Anything you'd care to respond to with regard to what Phil had to say?
Well, you know, I don't know where he gets his information about them giving false statements and lying, and you know, I'm not aware of that.
I'm not aware
of that being anywhere in the record. And it was never a murder investigation. There was an investigation of a homicide, which is a different thing altogether. Which is, you know, a death by something other than natural causes. So I can't address that. I'm not trying to dodge it. I just don't know about that. I've never heard that they made false statements, and you know, I don't know where the caller gets that information.
No, we don't. But I think it's another indication of the kinds of things that were circulating amongst large portions of the population here during this particular incident and others, that these things build on each other, not necessarily from a factual point of view.
No, I know there is this sort of love hate relationship with the family and the company out there. You know that they get away with everything. Their wealth certainly didn't get them away from tragedy. That didn't protect them from that. It never does.
You know, another aspect of all of this, with regard to the way people certainly here looked at the family, is that since InBev took over the company, the sale of the product has dropped rather significantly in this area.
I've heard that too. But it's dropped significantly, you know, everywhere. I mean, Budweiser has anyway. I mean, the people who took over the company are very good at making money and making more and more profit. but without selling any more beer, which is a problem, you know, going into the future. And you know, the very jaundiced view of it is that these guys who bought Anheuser-Busch really don't care about the brewery or beer. Their big play is PepsiCo. That's what they're going for. They're just using this, and they took over the company, and they're going to take out get rid of all the costs and cut back all the budgets and all the stuff that sort of made Anheuser-Busch what it was. You know, this extravagant free spending, you know, great benefits, all that, and squeeze as much out return to the investors, you know, which is what it's sort of about in American business now. It's all about how much you can return to the investors. But years ago, it was about more than that. It was about, you know, how many jobs you could provide to the community, how many, again, good lives you could produce, what you could contribute. It's less about that now. And the people who run it now, they're doing absolutely the best they can for the investors, and that will help the price if they go to sell it or do whatever they're going to do or trade it or whatever maneuver they make next. But is it really building value to the beers and the brands? I don't know.
And when you slice 2,000 jobs from the local economy, it doesn't help you win any popularity contests either.
That's gonna make a lot of people angry. It wasn't like the Bushes willingly did this. It was once that offer was made at that price, given where the stock was and where the economy was, and you know, some of the leadership things that had happened before that, there was that deal was going to go through. They couldn't turn that down. They had no option except to faint and do this and get the price up higher, which they did. They got it up to $70 a share. That was the best they could have done. That was the only, that was the happiest ending that could have been had at that point. So it wasn't like, you know, there's a lot of things, well, they just sold us out to make money. No, I think that they would have kept it going. Just the pride in the family and August the 3rd and all that would not have done that if he thought there was any other way.
We've been talking about the Bush men, and there were women involved in all of this, obviously, given that certainly the number of children that are involved. Let's talk for a moment or two about the women. Which of the women that you wrote about impressed you the most? We have Susie Bush, who was married to August III at one time. We have Trudy Bush, who was married to Gussie. And there were others. Which of the women impressed you the most, and why?
Well, it's sort of clear, I guess, if you read it. But you know, when I started to do this, I decided I would focus the story, because it's so sprawling and there's so many characters, on the five guys who ran the company and made an impression on, you know, on the company and American commerce, which were the five guys that I, and women did, you know, women in the Bush world. Weren't really considered part of the company in the sense that they, you know, the only one who ever had a significant job in the company was August the Third's sister, Susie, who some people think, you know, should have been the one who was trained to take over, and it might have turned out differently. But they weren't given positions in the company. It was male. It was the person to take over had to be male, the firstborn son, or if he died, then the secondborn, and that way the women were not considered. So. It wasn't, you know, chauvinism on my part. It was just the way it was in this world. But in researching the story, you know, you realize that Trudy Bush, who was completely dismissed by the press and by, you know, pretty much the public at the time as a bimbo, this 22-year-old thing or 23-year-old girl that he met when he was 57 or whatever it was, and became his third wife, she played an enormous role in all this in the sense that she was a terrific partner, a partnership. That love affair lasted, you know, 27 years. That marriage lasted 27 years, and seven children. And she was the hostess. She was she was Guinevere to his King Arthur at Camelot during those years when you know the world came to Gussie's door in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. You know, it wouldn't have been like that if Trudy hadn't been there, because she ran that place. And it was a big job. It was rich and it was comfortable and privileged and all the other stuff. And she had a big staff, but that was no easy job to manage all the entertaining and all the stuff that she had to do. And it was the same thing for the kids that lived there. It was rich. It was privileged and all that, but they had to work hard. There was when you got 200 wild animals on the property, there's a lot of chores that need to be done.
Trudy also happened to be beautiful. She was a stunning woman, wasn't she?
Right, and that worked against her in terms of people's image because, you know, here she was. The day she got married, one of the papers, I don't know if it was the Post-Dispatch or the Globe Democrat, you know, it said that August A. Bush marries Swiss girl. Like, it didn't even have her name, you know. And normally, wedding announcements and wedding papers, they say who the woman is. They just termed her a Swiss girl. Well, she was 25, so, but that was sort of the chauvinism of the age. But, you know, she was kind of dismissed and turned out to be a very formidable person.
There is another story involving one of the Bush women that gets a lot of attention here, even to this day. Were you able to unscramble the egg concerning Harry Caray's Susie Bush, who was then August III's wife, and their alleged affair?
My take on that has to do with the personal experience. The only person who can say for sure whether or not they had an affair would be Susie, the only living person. Harry is dead, and he sort of denied it over the years, but with less consistency than she did. There was one interview he gave that's on the record that sort of suggested he might have, and she sort of said no, but, you know, she definitely said no. But, you know, back at this, when this happened, I one of my jobs, you know, when I was struggling through college and whatever else, I was the maitre d' at Tony's restaurant, back when it was down, the old Tony's, when it was down nearer to where the old ballpark was. And my job was to seat people. I would greet people at the front door and take them to their seats. And one night, you know, Susie and Harry Caray came in. And, of course, you know, everybody on the staff, we all knew who Harry Caray was. She wasn't as recognizable, but it flashed around, you know, among the staff that, oh, my God, that's Mrs. Bush. She's with Harry Caray. He was very recognizable. And, you know, the way I can sum it up was we were all staring and looking because either they were an item or they were acting in a way because they wanted people to think they were an item. And to the point where the owner of the restaurant, Vince Bamarita, had to, you know, kind of look at us and say, quit staring, you know, stop this, you know, because we were all like, wow, you can leave that, you know. So that's my take on it. I don't know what that proves, but, you know, I know that the staff working in the restaurant that night certainly assumed that that's what was going on.
I wish I were sharper 25 years ago. I used to play racquetball with a lady by the name of Susie Bush, and I had no idea who I was playing racquetball with.
Well, you know, it was a big difference. You know, you would notice the two of them together because she was a stunningly beautiful blonde
beautiful.
who was, you know, I'm 27, and Harry was 50-something, this big, you know, clown face guy. You know, there was, what's wrong with this picture? You know.
Well, she used to beat me at racquetball too, by the way.
She was fairly pretty good. She was quite an athlete.
She was quite an athlete. I have a follow-up email here from Andy relating to something we have spoken about, asking what was he referring to when he answered my question about the future of Grant's Farm. We spoke of Bush family having until October of next year to decide on the future of the property.
I think that's when the lease with Anheuser-Busch or with InBev runs out, I think. I mean, for some reason, October 2013 sticks in my mind.
Yes.
And I think there's something happens on that they have to make a decision among themselves of what to do by October 2013. And forgive me that I don't know exactly what it is, but I know that's a date. Some sort of drop-dead date for something, some decision to be made.
We only have about 45 seconds left, Bill. What are people going to find out in a very, very capsulized form, find out in this book, do you think, that they didn't know before, really?
Well, I think it humanizes certain members of the Bush family who have been sort of a mystery before. I think it humanizes August the 3rd in a way. As I was going through and doing this stuff, I would always look for what's not answered out there. What are the mysteries still? And I would go and try and figure out what that was and shed some light on that. So I think that's one thing they'll take away. They'll have a better understanding of what it was like to be on the inside of that. Which I think would be particularly fascinating to people in St. Louis, and it certainly was to me. If I wasn't from St. Louis, I might not have thought that much about that.
There's one thing I almost forgot about here. We had an email from Tom Schlafly of Schlafly Beer, who was wondering when you wrote about Peter Jackson, sometimes called the Beer Hunter, referring to Michael Jackson?
Yeah, well, that's been changed. Yeah, right, exactly. Right.
Well, Tom Schlafly will be glad to hear that.
Tell him he caught something that's already been caught, but that's good proofreading.
I hope he's listening. And by the way, he says you've done a great job in telling this story.
Well, thanks.
Bill Nadel-Cedar, thank you so much for being with us. Congratulations on the book and good luck with it.
All right. Thanks. Okay. Bye-bye.
Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape, and he'll talk about a concert by noted Kirkwood High School alumni to benefit the orchestra's trip to Lincoln Center, a concert by cast members of Wicked to benefit Stage of St. Louis and Broadway Cares, and in the next installment of Soundbites produced with Sauce Magazine, he'll talk with food critic Michael Renner about the best of 2012. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll take a look at legal issues pertaining to the law with a panel of legal experts. Archived versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis On the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Aaron Dorr, Ariana Tobin, and Spencer Reed. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.